This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
We got some listener comments and listener questions from last week, and we are actually going to go over them, the ones left over that we did not get to last week. We're going to go over them next week. But this week, we're going to be talking about grudges, sports, and rivalry. Now, this already sounds kind of cool because for the most part, we've been talking about relationships and friendships and sex and dating, and basically how people are getting along with each other. But today, we're going to switch it up a little bit and talk about how it is that people don't get along with each other.
Very good.
So this all came from an article somebody sent me as a joke because they told me that this article would go perfect on the show because of all the touchy-feely stuff that is recommended in the article. So this article I read, I found from a Wikipedia-type website, and it talks about how to let go of a grudge. So, as you can tell, Dr. Lyle, from the website and probably from the author, you're going to have a good time dissecting this.
All right. We'll have some fun.
All right. So, number one, holding a grudge is hanging on to intense anger or dislike for others based on a real or perceived wrongdoing. So, here's the guidelines for letting go of grudges. Number one, acknowledge the hurt, the pain, or the dissatisfaction. It's not about denying that a problem exists. You have to name the emotions you are feeling, like write a journal, express your feelings, and that way you can understand the event that led to your anger or hurt.
All right. Let's go on.
Okay. The next one is speak to the offender. You have to speak to the person or company who has mistreated you, explain your feelings about being overcharged or mistreated, and that might lead to receiving an apology or an improvement.
Yeah, maybe. let's keep going. Let's see what else they've got.
All right, the other one, number three, is release expectations of people and processes and understand that human beings are imperfect and that we should let go of attachments of how things should be or how others should behave. And that should lower our stress level.
Well, you know, they're trying here, and they're picking around little pieces of this. And obviously, it's, you know, somebody's trying to give some decent advice. And what we're going to try to do here is to try to understand a little bit more about grudges and sort of where they come from. So, the reason we would have a grudge is that somebody, some entity, whether it could be in theory a company, but let's go back to the natural history of our species. In order to understand this emotion and motivational system, in other words, to remind or to explain to people, all of your feelings are essentially like parts of your body because they're actually nothing other than parts of your body under a specific set of circumstances. There's neurotransmitters flowing through a circuit that causes a specific feeling. So, in fact, these are physical events, and feelings are every bit the physical event that your elbow is or your fingers are or your ears are. And so your feelings are not sort of willy-nilly. They're, in fact, it's the activation of specified neural circuits, in order to accomplish a specific goal. And that goal is ultimately going to be to try to result in you having behavior that will be successful at leaving more genes on the planet than some alternative behavior. So you can imagine, in principle, that you could stick your hand in hot water and it might feel just very pleasant and it could be burning. And if that was your feeling when you stuck your hand in hot water and you had the genes that built the neural circuit in that way, those genes wouldn't be on the planet for very long because people would make mistakes and they would have horrible burns and they wouldn't know that it was happening. So your feelings are actually very, very tightly specified in order to try to instruct your behavior with respect to situations. So whether or not it's limping on a sprained ankle instead of walking normally on that ankle because you can't feel any pain, that pain is a device. It's an adaptive device just like the ankle is itself. So a grudge is the same thing. A grudge is not something mysterious, bad, immature, impulsive, stupid, or anything else. A grudge is a device. It's a device built into your nervous system to be activated under a particular set of circumstances. And those circumstances are that somebody took advantage of you. So they may either forced something down your throat that you didn't like, or they tricked you into it. But one way or the other, you got the raw end of a deal, and that you consider the way that it was done was very unfair. So it may have been through brute force that you could not object to it. You didn't have any choice. The people, the Norwegians came over, and they burned your village in southern England, and you couldn't stop them. Okay, and so now you hold a tremendous grudge against those Vikings. That's one way to do it. Another way to do it is somebody cheated you. Like they told you that they were going to give you 50 coconuts for the 50 oranges that you brought them last week, and then they didn't do it. They went off and left town and hiked over the next mountain, and it turns out they're on a 20-year trek, wandering the earth like Cain, and now you're never going to see them again. Now you're going to hold a grudge. So what are these grudges for? What they are is they're just like any other feeling. They're actually there to promote adaptive behavior. And in this case, it's behavior that says, remember who it is that screwed you and make sure that you are irritated, even being around them, thinking about them, so that if they offer you a value proposition, that you are very likely to say, no, you owe me, okay? And to feel even violent and threatening. And in other words, you're going to be trying to get even and even the score, or signal to them that this was unfair behavior, and you're angry about it. And so this is actually completely adaptive behavior. And now, when we can look at these prescriptions, I'm going to have you go over those again for me, so that from the light, from the angle of understanding that grudge packing is actually an adaptive strategy that was put into our ancestors to try to reduce the likelihood of repetitive exploitation. If they cheated you once, then you better be on guard against those people or anybody that even looks like them. Okay, so this is where you can get a grudge against a whole host of people, because if you had these people that wear purple hats. Well, you got screwed by one of these guys in a purple hat, and so now anybody that wears a purple hat, you're on guard against, and you hold a grudge against them, and you're entering into any possible trade relationship with them with a chip on your shoulder, being very paranoid and alert for the possibility that they could screw you. So these are the adaptive mechanisms of human nature. And so with that in mind now, let's go back and look at what they said. So give me the three little techniques again.
Okay, the first three is, number one is to acknowledge the hurt, the pain, or the dissatisfaction. Don't deny that a problem exists, or don't repress your underlying emotions. Just name the emotions you're feeling.
Okay, let's talk. Comes a bit from this notion in psychodynamic theory that we repress emotions and that they remain festering if we don't express them, blah, blah, okay? This is largely bullshit. It's not entirely bullshit for the following reason. And that is that we actually have some communicative pressure inside of us. When we feel cheated, we want to tell other people in the village. And when you don't tell other people in the village, you feel an urgency to do so. And so if you can tell somebody else and explain it to them, this is actually part of the process of how you're designed. And you can actually feel for various reasons, some satisfaction from doing this, from getting this communicated. You've actually communicated to the village that somebody else is not trustworthy. You've damaged those other people's reputation partly by telling the person that you've told. The notion that you can, quote, acknowledge your little hurt feelings and name them to yourself and that's going to help. This is a derivative of some work done in the 1960s at the University of Chicago by a psychologist by the name of Eugene Gendland, and a technique called focusing. And that technique, in this case, in most cases, it's got a little bit of a mild positive effect for people sometimes, but it's not going to have a lot of potency here. Yeah, go ahead. Now, so tell me the next thing.
Yeah, well, let's go over that because I'm curious.
Yes. Yes.
I understand that, you know, naming the emotions, just my personal experience, obviously, not very scientific.
Yeah.
But I understand from a personal standpoint, you know, talking to somebody about some issue where you feel wronged is great. But why is this scientifically mostly bullshit?
Oh, the reason is that the emotion has a purpose. So that purpose, and it's to energize a certain class of actions that are going to be adaptive for the organism. Now, what people like Gendlin and others have found is, let's suppose somebody walks into your office and you're a psychologist and they're all pissed off, okay? And they start communicating that they are angry, okay? Now, if I say to them, so they're telling me all their transgression, what they're all upset about. And so then I say to them, wow, you're really angry. It turns out that if I say that, that helps them. And the reason is that it means that I understand what they are trying to communicate. And so they feel relieved that, in fact, that communication has taken place, because that was the point to everything that they were saying. Okay? And then if I go on and I say, wow, you feel like you've been cheated. It's like, yes, I do feel like I've been cheated. Okay? So in other words, the emotion is shifting, because it's accomplishing, the communication is accomplishing the social goal that the entire emotion is being motivated to accomplish, you see. So this is why you will find emotion shifting, and you will not typically find big-time emotion shifting when a person just sits in their car all bent out of shape at their spouse and says, wow, I'm angry. Yeah, I'm angry. Like that, quote, acknowledging the emotion that you are personally feeling in your own private little cocoon isn't going to do anything to process this emotion particularly at all. What will process the emotion, and where this got confusing for psychologists, is that a huge amount of the purpose of having the emotion is to communicate that emotion to secondary parties, because so much of the emotions that we have are emotions about relationship issues with other people in the village. And so we are lining up support for our negotiations with this third party. So when we say things like, yes, I'm really angry, yes, I felt cheated, and the therapist says, oh, well, sounds like you really felt cheated. And so, yes, I do. Now the person feels relieved because they've actually started to build the coalition and have support. They're beginning to get support for their position. And so this is why they will find some shifting of emotion and a relief circuit will be going off behind this.
I see. Okay. Makes sense. And so the next point is...
Yeah, if you sprain your ankle and you are, you know, it does very little to reduce your pain to say, well, pain's just a perception. You know, I really feel the pain. No, that pain has a process that it's going through. And it's attempting, for example, to have you scream so that you can tell others in your coalition that you're in trouble, okay? Mm-hmm. And to elicit the social support so that you can know that you're safe even though you're injured. See what I'm saying? So these are some of the reasons why, like if you have a little kid that's on a playground that's all excited, right, and he's yelling, okay, and he's making a bunch of noise, you say, well, let's just acknowledge what you're feeling. Oh, I'm feeling excited. Like that's not going to reduce that kid's excitement. That kid's having these periodic explosions of noise coming out of him because periodic noise explosions in children are almost certainly a device for keeping their parents on edge because those screams of children on a playground sound an awful lot like children maybe being attacked by predators. And so it actually will keep a parent who's half dozing off, not paying attention, periodically having to shift their attention immediately to make sure the children are okay. So this is likely to be the reasons for the periodic, unpredictable exuberance that you will hear out of children, the shrieking that you'll hear, that you won't hear out of a 20-year-old. It's just not going to happen anymore because
so
now they're big and they don't have parents looking out for them.
That's why those kids shriek so loudly at the park near where I live all day long.
That's it. That's what they're doing.
So
just that mom's paying attention. Yeah, go ahead.
Just as an aside, just to kind of question the example, and what about those people who let's say they hurt their ankle and they just kind of by force of will, they're like, I'm not going to think of the pain. I'm just going to focus on something else. What's that process there?
Yeah, I mean, they could try to do that, but they're not going to find that's going to mitigate the pain very much. You're typically going to find in an injury the desire to scream and communicate that pain is very, very strong. That's undoubtedly a social process that's designed to elicit aid from other people. And so to try to stomp on that and not get yourself to do that and to try to focus elsewhere, the brain wasn't designed to focus elsewhere, okay? So it's not going to let you quiet that thing down. It needs you to know that you're in pain in order to organize your behavior with respect to the damage that's been done and where we're going to go from here to increase your likelihood of survival. So the but we're going to wind back to the grudge packing. So one of the things that could be useful, actually most people don't have any specific problems with grudges. They keep grudges where they're appropriate about some jerk that screwed them over, some company that screwed them over. These are just basic strategies inside of there. Now there is one time when this is there's times when it's problematic, and I will occasionally see an individual who is, spending quite a lot of mental energy spinning around something that they were taken advantage of, they were cheated out of a bunch of money. They're really upset about this, and and they may be stewing on this 2, 3, 4, 5 years later. Okay, this is going to happen. And one of the things that can be useful here is being alluded to in the third thing that the third prescription in this magazine, which is talking about gratitude, people are imperfect, et cetera. This can be potentially quite useful. It's usually not useful in the abstract. In other words, it's not usually useful for you to think about, for example, think about, well, there's people starving in Biafra, and you know, I got taken I had a guy that had a company that sold, and then he and his buddies made a couple of million dollars, and then it turned out some of the stock that they swapped for went bad, and they lost a bunch of money that they thought they had made, and you know, they're very upset about this, as was reasonable, but we're stewing on it 2, 3 years later, and these were all young, intelligent people that had done well and then didn't do as well as they had thought they had done. And they were pretty bent out of shape. And the part of the, you know, obviously you could look at the world and say, look, the whole world is half the world starving to death. Cash incomes of the average person in the world are $3 a day. You know, that's the median kind of income for people in the world, not the average, but the median. 50% of the people make, you know, less than $4 or $5 a day. Okay, this isn't going to help my Silicon Valley guy who thought he was a millionaire and now it turns out he's not. And after all, he's pushing 32 now, so you know he's pretty frustrated about this. Now, the thing is that so getting a perspective on your life in the abstract is not that easy. But getting a perspective on your life in vivo by actually visiting a hospital ward with a bunch of kids with cancer, that can make an impact on people. Okay? So by actually going and observing the fact that huge percentages of the world have it so much harder than you have it, and to understand also some other things that are useful to understand in principle. So in vivo or real life exposure in concentrated form, people who have had it difficult, is a very humbling experience for people and can really shake people out of their entrenched position that they have been treated so horribly and unfairly at whatever this thing is, okay, which is usually nothing other than the following. The truth of the matter is that this is a perspective that I try to use from a philosophical standpoint, and that is that the truth of the matter is nature is amoral. Nature is unbelievably brutal. Nature, if you think what this is what the philosophers call the tragic view of nature, and the tragic view of nature is correct. So the tragic view of nature is that all over the earth, it's predator-prey relationships all over the place. And in order for a predator to survive, a prey animal must die, okay? And this is not happening once in a while. This is a daily constant drama that goes on literally throughout the living world. Now, more children will youngsters will be born than can ever live to adulthood. They will be eaten. They will be damaged. They will be dead. Okay. The vast majority of male animals on Earth will never mate once in their lifetimes, and yet that was their biological purpose and that is their focus, and yet it will never happen. Okay. So there are the world is full of struggle and hardship for animals. And it turns out that human beings have skinned the cat. So they have figured out how to be amazingly cooperative, and they are not amoral. They actually have moral structures where they actually understand that it's in their best interest to have a mutually cooperative process that goes on where we trade the best that we each can do, and we're all better off as a result of this trading process. Now, you can only imagine the fact that of course, that since we're animals, it's going to take place that there's going to be a little bit of viciousness in this process, and there's going to be people that are going to try to take advantage of other people. Of course that's true. So in this lifetime, I can guarantee you that you're going to run into circumstances where somebody's going to take advantage of you. They may trick you. So you're going to get tricked a bunch of times. And it's going to turn out you're going to buy a big sack of potato chips, and you're going to pay $2.99 for a big sack, and you're going to open it up at home, and it's only going to be half full. And you're going to be like, what the hell? Okay? And so that company is going to want to do that because the other companies are doing it. And so everybody's cheating and chiseling a little bit. So these processes are inevitable, and once in a while, you're going to get burned. You're going to get burned in love. You're going to get burned in friendships. You're going to get burned in commerce. You're going to get burned. And all that we can reasonably do is say, listen, at the end of the day, if you got burned, there may be a lesson for you to be learned in it. And there may be features of this situation where you weren't on your guard enough, you trusted somebody too much, you made yourself too vulnerable. Or it may be that you acted reasonably, but it is one of these situations where there was a conflict of interest between you and another person, and you wound up getting burned by somebody who drew the lines differently than you drew them. That's fair enough. We have to have the attitude that the world has a tragic backdrop, and we have a shining potential of human beings to have a very good life despite of that, rather than a utopian backdrop about how everybody is supposed to be great and everything is supposed to be fair and everything's supposed to be on the up and up and everybody's supposed to do everything right. And then when they don't do it, we're all bent out of shape and upset and tearing our hair out and looking for our congressman, okay? The correct view is the first view. The correct view is the tragic view. And if we can grasp and understand the tragic view, it doesn't mean that life is tragic. It means that it has tragic conflicts of interest in it. And once we understand this principle, we can be truly have more gratitude about how well the circumstances really are for us and for so many people. And we can let go of the fact that we got chiseled in a business deal or got chiseled in a situation. We didn't make first team on the varsity when we darn well deserved it because some other kid's, you know, mom flirted with the coach. So what? Okay? So what? It is not all going to be fair. And in fact, to be truthful and honest, it isn't that life isn't fair. Life isn't even remotely fair. Okay? Once we understand that life isn't even remotely fair, we realize that once in a while we're going to get burned, and that's part of the price of living, and it's just fine.
And of course, a few episodes back, you were talking about personality differences and how if somebody's disagreeable, their fairness line is drawn a little bit further away from fair, so they might be constantly feeling chiseled, constantly having a perceived need to hold grudges.
That's correct. And you're going to find that that's going to be true. So you're going to find that it is the angry people, it's the mafiosos that are going to be, and their ilk and their genetic ilk, that are going to be, you know, holding the biggest, baddest grudges, and that are going to be plotting their revenge, and so on and so forth. And so this is part of the price of being dealt those hand of genetic cards. Beating your genes is going to involve trying to get smarter than that and doing the kinds of things that I'm talking about. Being educated enough to understand the philosophical position that I'm talking about is very useful. And also by understanding that other people, so many other people, have had such incredibly bad decks dealt to them, to confront those people with your own eyeballs and to see just how hard it is that their existences are, should hopefully release from you the energy that is directed at you making sure that you get that 7% that you had coming to you.
Mm-hmm. Now, going on to number four for this letting go of grudges, is they say remove yourself from unjust situations and refrain from acting from interacting with people that are perpetually unfair or unjust. Does that seem reasonable to you?
Well, very good. Sure, it sounds very reasonable. And so, and this is, again, being smart enough to understand that, and being insightful enough, I should say, not smart enough. Insightful enough to understand that there are people, maybe close to your life, that are disagreeable inherently, and they can't help themselves. They're 80-20 traitors. They're 70-30 traitors. And you're going to find that they're irritable. They're disagreeing with people. They disagree with you. They interrupt you, et cetera. And so they've got – and as a result of that, you can count on getting, you know, a bunch of rough processes. And so, of course, the smart job in life is to plot your course of life towards the agreeable half of the graph. There are 320 million people or so in the United States. That means there's 160 people that are at the 50th percentile or higher for agreeable. You know, a very smart way to live this life is to move your little tentacles towards those people and away from people on the other side of the graph.
Very good. You know, this article is actually more impressive, it sounds like, than some of the other articles we've gone over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. They're thinking it through to some degree. They're seeing some, you know, kernels of truth in this, and it's all good.
Except for this one. It says hold a letting go ceremony.
I knew there had to be some bullshit in here somewhere. I've been a party to these sorts of ceremonies in clinical psychology. This is I think this came in with the 1960s and Gestalt therapy and some other imaginative kind of therapeutic processes. And I don't know of any evidence that supports it. Maybe somebody does, but I have watched this process myself. I've been on therapy teams that have directed this kind of ritual, and I've never seen it do anything. So other than a little bit of showing off at the moment of the ritual. So I wouldn't expect this to be useful. But good luck.
Well, Jeffrey Miller would probably argue that this is a mating ceremony rather than a letting go ceremony, right?
Yes, he undoubtedly would. And he would be right.
All right. So the other ones are fairly similar to what you've already talked about. Focus on forgiving the person, choose peaceful and productive thoughts. And then the last one
yeah,
is
I would
practice
stop
daily.
There.
Oh, okay.
Hold on. I want to stop. Forgiving the other person. You know, the truth is that you can't forgive another person electively. This is not a voluntary process for your nervous system. Your nervous system has feelings and creates actions that are consistent with your best analysis of what the truth is. And so you can't tell yourself, well, I have to forgive. You can't, it's going to do nothing. Your nervous system is designed by nature to run an algorithm that says, you know what? That person cheated me. They knew what they were doing. I need to hold a grudge and remember that they did that, et cetera. They're dangerous and I'm irritated. And not only that, I want to push their reputation around and possibly alarm them to make them feel guilty and then give me a concession so we're even. Okay? That's how the nervous system is built. To try to top down waltz in here and say, forgive them, is ludicrous. That's not going to happen. Okay? Now, what can happen is you can find yourself reducing the amount of energy and attention towards this issue by doing the other things that I talked about, by understanding more deeply the tragic view that we have in life and that they're just a tough little organism that was out to try to steal some of your life's energy. And that's what they did, and they got away with it. Okay? Fair enough. In other words, we're not forgiving them. We're understanding and acknowledging their motivation, and we're understanding and acknowledging that if we play in the National Basketball Association, the referees are not going to get every call right. And some nights they're going to call them worse on our team than they call them on the other team, and it's going to be unfair, but that's part of the price we pay for playing in this league and part of the price we play for playing in the game of human interaction, trade, and get things from other people is that we're going to get disappointed and we're going to get cheated from time to time. That's a different issue than forgiving that individual. I don't know that I would forgive an individual for having cheated me. Okay? I don't think so. I'm going to remember it. I'm going to feel the grudge. I'm going to be holding that grudge the next time I'm interacting with them. But I'm not going to be twisted out of shape about this indefinitely because I will have understood a more global perspective. And that's how we file down the negative feelings. We don't electively get rid of them.
That makes a lot more sense. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. And then how about choosing peaceful and productive thoughts? From what I'm hearing and from what we've talked about this entire show, is you can't really
Yeah.
choose your thoughts any more than you can choose which emotion you feel if you touch a burning
No.
stove.
No. It's useful to become more knowledgeable about the brain's processes. Because the person who understands more about the brain's processes actually has more options inside their mind, and they can now shift what it is that they may their mind may find a more appropriate priority to optimize their happiness. See what I'm saying? So that's why it's useful to become philosophical and facile and try out sort of be open to trying out new different strategies for handling situations like this. So, one of the things that's useful, for example, is that sometimes if people are very stressed or upset about anything, it turns out a good strategy is to very much change your location. Like get in the car and drive 100 miles to some lake, okay? It turns out that very often by changing dramatically your physical surroundings, it will change your whole mind's matrix as you run a cost-benefit analysis over all the issues in your life. We don't tend to understand this very directly, but you are an animal, and the ecological circumstances surrounding your sensate experience have very large implications for how it is that you are thinking and feeling at any given time. And so if you are in a twisted rut One of the best, even though that rut still exists, when you drive back to Los Angeles from Big Bear Lake, you still got the boss there that told you you're being demoted and you're still upset about it. But when you went to Big Bear and walked around the lake, you actually got to soak in some change and some positive changes in the environment that actually start to help you get perspective over this whole thing in a way that you can't if you're sitting in your apartment. So this is one of the things that you can do to sort of shift your way out of some of these experiences that are unpleasant.
Now, if somebody is much, much more conscientious than the average person, will they also feel like they're getting chiseled more often, or will they pay attention to this more often?
They probably will, just because they're pretty fastidious, and they're because of their. So you could have a highly conscientious person that's, say, average in agreeableness, and that person could feel pretty upset a lot more often, because so often on the other side of transactions, people are going to get a little bit sloppy, and they're going to try to take a little bit of advantage over a little bit of the slop. So let me give you an example. So if you're a boss, a supervisor that's extremely conscientious, you're going to be more upset when people drag in 5 minutes late to that government job. Okay? It's going to upset you. It's going to upset you a lot more than someone who is less conscientious. So as a result, and you're going to feel that irritation, and you're going to feel like you need to talk to your employees, and your employees are going to be like, "What are you talking about? I belong to a union. You're lucky I'm even here." Okay. So the point is that yes, you are pointing out something, that it isn't just the disagreeable, it's also the highly conscientious that are going to have more of these little perturbations in the system. And of course, the people that are more emotionally unstable are, if you're highly conscientious and more emotionally unstable, then these perturbations are going to be more acute. Okay? Instability is neither good nor bad. It's really simply about how big the amplitude up and down is on the graph. And so as a result, if you're highly conscientious, God forbid, you're highly conscientious and you are disagreeable and you are unstable. That is, by the way, Steve Jobs screaming at everybody in the office that something was done, a little tiny mark on the inside of the apple wasn't in the right place. Okay? That's what that is.
And so earlier in the show, when you said that if you remember, say, for example, somebody having a purple hat,
Yes.
or somebody having, and so you want to make sure that anybody with the purple hat, you remember. Is this
Yes.
what happens on the freeway when somebody cuts you off, and as you pass them, you look to see what kind of person would do that to you?
Oh, when you're looking at that, you're trying to assess that whole situation, and so you're trying to see, is this some tough-looking, lowbrow human being, with a tattoo that's dangerous, or that this was an aggressive act, probably consciously, or do we see that it's a 50-year-old lady, I'm saying, with glasses on and silvering hair. And that's well dressed, and we look at her and we realize, oh my God, she's just an idiot and didn't know what she was doing. So it's through these scans that we are trying to assess the motivation of the individual and their nature, and that's why that has such a major impact on our subsequent feelings.
Very interesting. And the very last one is to practice daily gratitude, which is to start looking for the good in your days and stop seeking the bad.
Yeah, well, this is, I think that's maybe a little simplistic. It'd be a little simplistic for me, but it's a simplistic version of what it is that I was talking about. And that is that to understand that the world has been and always has been a fierce place for life to attempt to struggle to survive. And that it wasn't designed for us to enjoy it. It was designed with little enjoying moments in this thing in order for us to do things that would be conducive to the reproduction of the genes. it's going to turn out that human beings, through their extraordinary ingenuity, have been able to master enough of the factors of survival that we can now actually focus on enjoyment of our existence. That's fancy, and that's pretty special, and we're very lucky. And there's some other animals that are lucky too, like our domesticated animals that live with us. Okay, they too are in a very similar situation to us, and they've got a nice protected existence from the tragic view of existence. And as a result, our job is a good starting place is to understand how fortunate we are, and whatever our struggles are and what our handicaps are, we begin the journey from a very good position relative to what we might have expected. And from that, let's complain less and enjoy more and focus on, how processes that are positive.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's turn the compass a little bit and go over sports. Sports is kind of one of the common places where I hear people talking about grudges quite loudly in a fun way. Why is it that we play sports?
Yeah, sports are an example of what we're going to call a fitness indicator. And so the fitness indicators are devices that are used to signal gene quality. Probably the best way to think about gene quality is simply what we're going to call mutation load. So let me talk about various fitness indicators. So a fitness indicator would be how well someone can talk. Someone with a lot of mutations in their head, in their neural circuits, and they got a bunch of lousy, mediocre neural circuits full of mistakes, can't talk very well. Okay. Also how well you could write. That wouldn't be a direct fitness indicator, but it's a natural extension of your ability to speak. Let's talk about another fitness indicator, how beautiful you are. So that's a way of counting mutations to see, just how good the gene quality is of that individual. And so we start to see fitness indicators, anything that is difficult to do, that people are making a display of this in a competitive fashion, is a way to say that whoever does it best has less mutations. So if you watch the Olympics recently, you see what the world has done is they've actually gone after all kinds of little problems, and they have made those problems into competitive hierarchies with a way of judging the performance to try to indicate whether that performance had fewer or greater errors in it. So when you really look at all sports, this is the analysis of the errors of movement, okay? And so can the brain orchestrate movement in a way that is as accurate as possible? So in principle, if you were an extraordinary machine, the game of basketball would be a joke, because all you do is you'd throw the ball in to an individual, and they'd turn and they'd throw it up 80 feet and they'd go in the basket, okay? That is in principle possible. In other words, the human being is a human being strong enough to throw the ball there, could be in principle accurate enough to throw it in the hoop. But it turns out that you can't, because the nervous system is not so beautifully orchestrated that anybody can do it. So what we can do is we can find out who can do it better, and we're going to make a contest out of it. So these are just like beauty is an indicator of, quote, how fit. Well, by fitness indicator, I don't mean how fit you are athletically. I mean how fit you are in the game of survival of the fittest. And in this case, what's an important issue here is, do you have the best genes in order to reproduce with? So what sports are is they are a display of a genetic hierarchy. Who has the best genes is really the question that is being answered by sport. And that's why we're going to find that specifically male sports heroes will be highly sought after as mates.
And so why do people engage in grudges and rivalries with sports? It seems like it's is it just two villages, fighting against each other?
Yes. Yes, I actually think that that's exactly what it is. In other words, you're sort of a Stone Age brain that understands that there are groups of people. We have in us the natural capacity to divide the world of a group of people into what we're going to call the in-group and the out-group. And this tendency to actually divide people up into groups was, I mean, certainly it's been commented upon for centuries, but it was formally first understood as a principle by a psychologist, social psychologist by the name of Henry Toffel in England in about 1970 or so. And what Toffel did was he, for anybody who's interested, Tajfel, I believe. So what Toffel did was he created experiments on what he called minimal groups. And so let me give you an example of a minimal group, and we can see what happens. So we could walk into a room and say things like, okay, you guys on this side of the room, you're the blues, and you guys on the other side are the greens. Okay? So we haven't actually had any objective thing about these people that the blues are good at something, or we believe the blues, you know, came from the west side of town. Nothing. A bunch of random people in a room, and we just say, the blues on the left, the greens on the right. Now we have them engage in various and sundry tasks, you know, verbal learning tasks or poetry or, you know, drawing pictures on the board, whatever. It's going to turn out that if you have the green people analyze everybody, you've got to take a green person in the room and you have them rate everybody in the room on how they're doing. They rate the green people better than the blue people. If you have a blue person in the room, they rate the blue people better than the green people. So it's going to turn out that the minimum amount of information necessary to delineate two groups creates an in-group, out-group effect in human beings. You can literally do it and hit them unconsciously, walk into a room and say, okay, I'm thinking about dividing the group right here, these people on, you guys on that side, the other on the other side, and then don't say anything else. And then an hour later, you do a process like this, and you would get a minimal group effect. That the people that happen to be on the left will rate people that are over there talking to them as higher than the people on the right. So this tendency obviously is deep in human natural history to favor our group against your group. So what sports are is they delineate groups, different color jersey, different name of the mascot, different town we come from, different school, etc. It's very clear us against them, okay? And that us against them in human natural history could in principle be dangerous. And so as a result, it can get pretty ferocious and people can get all upset about it. And it's going to turn out that if you watch the testosterone levels of males that are watching NFL games, you will find that after their team wins, the males that are watching from their home TV have their testosterone levels rise. And the men who have watched their team lose will have their testosterone levels drop. Okay, this is likely to mean that the vi at victory at warfare in village warfare probably related to at least one thing, maybe raping and pillaging, but certainly also related to more likely sexual activity for the victor, one way or the other, maybe with their own mates. So this the process of victory in these things clearly has a heavy evolutionary footprint, and that's why we can get in-group, out-group, and potentially grudges, rivalries, all that sort of thing. It's remember, it's going to be very likely human beings are not going to be honest in terms of their ability to analyze whether a game was played fairly. It's going to be part of human nature is going to be set to be somewhat a bit personally biased. So I call it 55-45. I believe that the human being, the average human being's chip, fairness chip, is set about 10% in their own direction. So it's not 50-50. We're going to add 10% to our 50, and we're going to wind up at 55. So this is why the average sports fan feels like, particularly anytime their team loses, they feel like the referees have cheated them. Okay? So I've never heard in my life, I've never heard a sports fan say that his team won because the refs seemed to give his team the game. I have never heard this.
I had one friend who was like that, And he
Oh
was a
my
referee,
God.
and he taught me how to be a referee also. I refereed hockey.
Yeah.
And he would always, he
Yeah.
was super, of course, he was the very, very, very conscientious guy. And
Yeah.
he would oftentimes say, yep, they gave us the game there. And we used to say, are you crazy, Phil? Really? You're going to go and say that? Don't spoil our thunder.
Right. Very interesting. So you had actually an expert, a subject matter expert, and the very nature of that expert that he was very high conscientious. And so yeah, that's you've now given me an experience that I never thought I would ever have. I never thought that there was such an individual, but it turns out there was one. So you're going to see behind these biases, you can see how this is going to be ripe for rivalries. So you're going to see that if the Raiders beat the 49ers, that the 49er fans are going to feel like they got cheated, at which point they're going to feel like we have to get them next time because they cheated us, the referees cheated us, or that team cheated us. You know, things were done unfairly, and we and our genes don't look as good. Our genes are better than their genes, and yet their genes displayed as better than our genes. So that in effect, they're going to be able to charm and take our women, and this is not fair. Okay, and so they can actually be anger, disappointment, all kinds of emotions, and then a determination to win the next game to assert and display our true and rightful superiority. That is in the system, and that's what makes the NFL the NFL.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.